Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Good evening and welcome to the Arthur Ludlow Memorial Baths Newport for this year's finals of the All England Summer Ice Proust competition.
Marcel Proust had some brilliant ideas about how art can be transformative, but can a novel be philosophical?
So much to talk about. Memory, identity, art, enchantment.
How can you talk about that all in one novel?
Well, it's a very long novel.
Each contestant has to give a brief summary of Proust's à la recherche du temps perdu, once in a swimsuit and once in evening dress.
Why read Proust in the 21st century?
Total loser. Spent 20 years writing a book almost no one reads.
Our guest is my co-host, Josh Landy, who's written a new book, The World According to Proust.
Larry Sugarman is perhaps the second most highly regarded Proust scholar in the U.S.
Who's number one?
That would be me, Rich.
In search of Proust's philosophy.
Marcel Proust.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Could a novel change your life?
Is art a way to re-enchant the world?
What does Proust tell us about our true selves?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy, and Blakey teaches in the Philosophy and Literature program. Welcome back to the co-host chair, Blakey.
Glad to be here. Today we're out in search of Marcel Proust's philosophy.
Which is why you're here today, and why Josh will actually be joining us as our guest later. You know, he's got a brand new book about Proust.
Oh, I love Proust.
Yeah, he's that French guy who wrote that really long novel, In Search of Lost Time.
You know, every time I read that novel, I feel like I'm falling in love with it all over again. It has something to illuminate every stage of life, whether it's the falling in love stage, the parenting stage, or the gout stage.
You know, Blakey, that's just like the narrative device that Proust uses to talk about falling in love with people. He has this character, Swan, who falls in love with this other character, Odette, for the first time, except that that happens for like five times over the course of the novel. And he falls in love for a different reason every time.
Yes, and every time it feels like she's completely special. No one could replace her. Too bad that's all an illusion.
Wait, so Proust is telling me that all my grand romantic passions are fake? Isn't that kind of depressing?
It's not so bad. Love might be an illusion, but it connects you to something that is real.
Oh yeah, like what? Not the person you love.
No, but it connects you to your true self. And if you look at a work of art that someone else created, you can get a window into their true self.
Oh, come on, Blakey. How hard can it be to know your true self? I know lots of things about myself. It's not that difficult. So right now, I want tea and I want a cookie. Ooh, maybe a Madeleine. See, I don't need great art for that.
But Ray, that's not real self-knowledge. It's shallow and fleeting. You can eat the Madeleine, and then 5 minutes later you'll want something else. What about your real self, the part that doesn't change?
Yeah, I don't know. Do I even have a real self? My beliefs change, my feelings change moment to moment, my body ages, even my ideals eventually change.
Yes, but Proust thinks that underneath all that, there's something that doesn't change.
But I can't find it, and I've looked.
Where'd you last put it?
I don't know. I've tried therapy, journaling, taking classes in the philosophy of mind. I've tried everything.
Well, that is your problem right there. You're trying too hard. Why not take a bite of that Madeleine and relax?
How does that help?
When the narrator in Proust's novel eats a Madeleine, a flood of involuntary memories wash over him. He thinks about his childhood, and suddenly he's right there. He's experiencing the exact same joy that he felt as a child.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to just start going through my memories one by one, and then I'll find my true self.
It doesn't work exactly like that. So sifting through your memories on purpose is like trying to fall in love on purpose. If you try to force it, it's not really authentic.
But I thought love was an illusion. How do I know my authentic self isn't an illusion too?
I bet Josh will have something to say about that. We'll be talking to him about his new book, The World According to Proust, and that's why I'm filling in for him as host today.
Ha, I can't wait to have Josh in the hot seat.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to contemplate how smell and taste influence our memories and sense of self. She files this report.
When Hannah Spiegelman was getting her master's in gastronomy and studying food, she found people talked about Marcel Proust constantly.
It really blew my mind in terms of how taste and memory are so intertwined and how everything can affect taste and how that can change memory.
In the first volume of his novel, Proust's narrator tastes a madeleine dipped in tea, sending him back to a childhood memory. Hannah can relate. She helps people to think about historical people and places through ice cream flavors.
I did an ice cream based on Proust's madeleine moment.
On her blog, A Sweet History, you can learn about flaming Cheeto apple brandy ice cream with chili drinking chocolate swirl dusted in gold. That one is inspired by the most written about woman in New Mexico history, Doña Tulis, who ran a gambling hall in Santa Fe during the 1800s.
I truly believe that food is all you need to learn about in order to understand everything in this world.
Great Moon Cocktail and Clam Juice Ice Cream with Blueberry Blue Corn Fleur Thumbprint Cookies. That one is for Sir John Herschel, a British astronomer whose aunt was the first female scientist to receive a salary.
I could make ice cream and make it super unappetizing, which would be a statement, but I do want people to have an additional experience that's adding to the story. So that's the goal for me.
Proust got people thinking about food and memory. And then there are aspects of Proust's writing itself you never forget.
Like the longest sentence in Proust, which is 958 words.
Gloria Frim is another person influenced by Proust as a reader rather than an ice cream maker.
And I have a poster in my study that has it diagrammed.
She's a poet and professor at California College of the Arts and author of the book How Proust Ruined My Life and Other Essays.
The number of dependent clauses and digressions is phenomenal. I tried to take a picture of it to show it to you, but it doesn't photograph properly because, you know, the print is so tiny.
Gloria says because our minds can't retain big chunks of text or digressions, reading Proust feels new every time. In the mid-80s, she picked up the second volume of In Search of Lost Time while waiting for her baby to arrive.
I actually tried to read Proust to her, and she cried mercilessly. She wasn't interested in the beautiful sentences.
Gloria's students rarely make it past the first volume. You have to be ready for Proust. 15 years later, she read the novel with a group of other writers, and that time around, she fell in love.
What else can I say? There's no other word for what happened. I didn't want to read anything else.
She took Proust to Mexico, Spain, the Bahamas, the East Coast, and that is how Proust ruined her life. It created this habit of focusing on one writer. Some folks come and go, not Proust. She says he's a paradise of language.
All you have to do is love Proust. You don't have to be an academic, and you don't have to be analytic, because he does enough of that for you.
And so it makes sense to end this report with some Proust and a classic 599-word sentence. Here we go. But I had seen first one and then another of the rooms in which I had slept during my life, and in the end I would revisit them all in the long course of my waking dream, rooms in winter, where I'm going to bed.
I don't think any of our contestants this evening have succeeded in encapsulating the intricacies of Proust's masterwork.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that vivid report, Holly. I'm Ray Briggs. With me is my Stanford colleague, Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for our usual co-host, Josh Landy. And today, we're in search of Proust's philosophy.
We're joined now by a very special guest, Josh Landy. He's professor of French and comparative literature at Stanford and author of a brand new book, The World According to Proust. Josh, welcome back to the Philosophy Talk guest chair.
Yeah, thanks. It's so much fun to be back in this chair.
So, Josh, you've written a number of books about Proust now. Can you tell us about your first encounter with him?
Oh, Lord, yeah. It was at college, and we were supposed to read the first volume of Proust and then write an essay about it in 2 weeks. And after a week, I'd got to page 72 but forgotten everything that I'd read. So I started again. And then, like, day six of week two, I got back to page 72. And I had to confess to my tutor that I wasn't going to be able to turn a paper. I was mortified. It was the only time I failed to turn in something at college.
Well, you obviously struggled to finish even the first volume of In Search of Lost Time. What would you say to encourage someone who's thinking about reading all seven volumes?
I mean, there is absolutely nothing like it. It's true that it's an investment, right? So it's 3,000 pages and often pretty dense pages, long sentences. But it totally changed the way that I think about art and selfhood and memory and just the experience of it and just the existence of it. It's like the Sistine Chapel ceiling. You can't believe it exists. It makes the world a more beautiful place.
So I want to hear, like, one of the things that you got out of reading this long, long novel.
Oh, gosh, there's so many. One of the things I find fascinating is this discussion about conscious illusion, that sometimes you can deceive yourself knowingly and even deliberately, but it still sort of works.
So how would somebody go about doing that?
Well, there's one really nice example where the main character, who's not really named, is trying to get over a relationship. So he's this on-again, off-again sort of relationship with Gilberte, and it seems like she's not really into him. So he decides, I'm not going to see her again. But he keeps getting these invitations to go to tea at her family and things like that, and he keeps rejecting them. He says, no, I can't come. The way he manages to do it is to tell himself, this is the last invitation I will reject. I'll accept the next one. And it works.
So that's really puzzling. Like if you're tricking yourself, how do you believe yourself? Do you think there's an answer in Proust, or does he just present us with this puzzling phenomenon and not tell us what's going on?
Well, there's no explicit explanation, but I think between the lines, we can see the answer, which is that in Proust, the self is divided. And one of the ways it's divided is into various simultaneous components. So, for example, if you're in a relationship, you don't quite trust the other person, part of you believes that they are a good partner, and the other part of you believes they're running around all over town. So in this kind of case, well, part of you believes that you will accept the next invitation, and part of you doesn't believe. And so that's the way in which you're able to sustain these benevolent illusions.
Do you think that his view of the divided self has where did he get this, Josh?
Well, you know, he took some philosophy classes in school, and he was very interested in various philosophical ideas. But, you know, he wasn't professionally trained. I think a lot of this, he's just a brilliant mind who's figuring out a lot of things for himself. But yeah, he's certainly reading like the French moraliste, and he's in the Bergson circle, and so he's sort of hanging out in those milieus, but I don't know exactly where he gets the divided self from.
But he manages to come up with a theory that will essentially prove to be the theory of mind for the 20th century. He just saw it.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's so interesting, that Proust talks a lot about the unconscious and unconscious forces and unconscious this and unconscious that. He hadn't read any Freud. And part of that is just because the whole notion of the unconscious was very much in the air at that time. You know, lots and lots of folks in the 19th century already talking about unconscious forces and even the unconscious. So, yeah, he's very much in the moment, philosophically speaking. And as you say, you know, ends up with this really elaborate and kind of brilliant theory of personal identity.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Marcel Proust with our resident expert, Josh Landy, author of The World According to Proust.
How can we find enchantment in a godless world? Is love the answer? Can we find ourselves through social climbing or looking at beautiful flowers?
Marigolds, Madeleines, and making magic, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Stressed out. If you could turn back time to the good old days, what would you find? I'm Ray Briggs. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for Josh Landy. And we're out in search of Proust's philosophy with our very own Josh Landy, author of The World According to Proust.
Got questions about Proust and his monumental novel, In Search of Lost Time? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
Josh, Proust thinks that the modern world has become disenchanted. Can you explain what he means by that?
Well, yeah, you know, the sociologist Max Weber said that's sort of what modernity is, or at least one of the things modernity is, the progressive disenchantment of the world. So, you know, one example is, you know, people used to look at rainbows and see the goddess Iris, or maybe God's covenant with the world, and now we kind of see prismatic refraction, and they still look nice, but we don't expect there to be, you know, a leprechaun with some gold under the rainbow or something like that.
But we still see gay pride, don't we?
Well, thank goodness that we can re-enchant, right? So there are ways, that's kind of where Proust's going, that, you know, it's all is not lost. On the one hand, we've sort of collectively driven sprites and angels and things out of the world. But on the other hand, we can bring them in through a different door.
Wait, so why do I want to enchant the world? Like, a lot of that sounds like superstition. Like, I shouldn't really believe in sprites and angels, should I?
No. So what you really want, according to folks like Proust, is a secular form of re-enchantment, right? So now, of course, many people are still believers, right? So that's, yeah, but I'm thinking about the segment of the population that ceased to believe in traditional forms of religion and certainly, you know, the pantheon of Greek gods and things like that. What those folks want is a secular replacement. So something, you know, something you can really believe in, something that's real, but also enchanting, so that because the world isn't quite enough. Well, you want there to be more than meets the eye.
Right. I mean, isn't there a risk of getting further illusions from that? So you mentioned some illusions that Proust's narrator cultivated him in himself about his love, Gilbert, to get through things easier. Like, how do I avoid just deluding myself while I'm enchanting myself?
Fair point. So, I mean, you know, sometimes you're just going to want the bare truth. Sometimes you're going to want to deceive yourself, as in the case of, you know, refusing the invitations. But sometimes there's this kind of sweet spot in the middle where there's a genuine form of enchantment. And in Proust, art is the ultimate example of that. So art is real, right? It's not a sprite. It's not a goblin. It's something real that genuinely enchants the world.
So what is it like to be enchanted by art, according to Proust? What do you feel when you're experiencing that modern re-enchantment?
Well, I think one of the main things you feel is contact with another human being at the most profound level, which in the novel, as the two of you were saying earlier, is really elusive. It's really hard within the world of the novel to get to know somebody at a deep level through regular interaction. But if you read their novel, if you look at their paintings, if you listen to their compositions, that's real contact. And that's magical, but it's also real.
What if you try to make art and it's just kind of crappy art? Are you just stuck? Can nobody know you truly then?
That's a great question. So the official story within the novel is that only somebody who's able to use the resources of an artistic medium is really able to communicate themselves. Interestingly, even to themselves. They can't even know themselves without making great art because we're too self-deceived. But between the lines, I think we get a kind of softer picture, more moderate picture, which is, well, it's about style. But, you know, you can have style in your everyday life. You can have style in your mode of conversation. And so maybe all isn't lost if, like me, you're a pretty bad novelist. I don't even bother.
You've
to
written
try.
A novel?
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't have a novel in me, right? I definitely don't have a great painting in me. But maybe all is not lost, even for people like me, right? That there's a way for us to live with style and thus communicate something about who we really are.
So style, in my view, often has to do with display. It has to do with social climbing, which we've already sort of said is not a source of transcendence or meaning. So how do you navigate, or how does Proust navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point too. And in Proust, very often there's a good form of something and a bad form. And so there's a good way of, you know, appreciating art in a bad way. And there's a great scene where Vinteuil, the composer, we've rediscovered his magnum opus, the septet, and we're all listening to it. And the narrator is having the greatest artistic experience of his life while everyone else around him is basically chattering or falling asleep. And so, right, there's always a good way and a bad way, but there is a good way within art. There's a way of really devoting yourself to the craft of art making so that it's not about social climbing. It's not about showing off. It's really about getting in touch with something really important. And on the other end, there's a way of receiving that art that puts you in contact with another human being.
I like the idea that art can put me in touch with people who make art, but I also, like, I want experiences of love and friendship, and I don't think Proust's narrator really gets much of that. Isn't that sad? Like, don't I want that too as a way of getting in touch with other human beings?
Oh, absolutely. You should want it. And, you know, there's some question as to whether we should think that the novel is ultimately on the side of art to the exclusion of other forms of contact. The nice thing is all isn't completely lost within the world of the novel. There are some cases of genuine love. And the one I like the most is the great painter, Elstir. So there's a character in the novel who's a great painter. And, you know, so many of the characters in the novel are having these awful love relationships where it's riddled with jealousy and the people chose each other for terrible reasons and it barely hangs together. But this is a couple, they've been together for decades. And he fell in love with her because she incarnates his ideal of beauty that he'd been carrying around with him as a great artist. And that has never changed. And they're incredibly happy. And so, again, between the lines, I think we can see a less pessimistic picture.
I also want to know more about connecting to myself. So, like, art is a way that I can do that. Are there other things that I can do to sort of know who I really am?
Yeah, there are actually quite a few in the novel. And love is actually one of them, funnily enough, because if you fall in love over the course of your life with more than one person, at least according to Proust's narrator, you'll start to detect a pattern, right? There's something the people that you're with have in common. And what that is something to do with your preferences. And so you can actually work back. You have to work back from your choices in the world, because if you just sit in a room introspecting, trying to understand, like, oh, what kind of a person am I? You're not going to get anywhere. We're human beings are it's too easy to deceive ourselves, get it wrong. We're very opaque to ourselves. But look at the things that you do. Look at the choices you make, and you'll start to see yourself.
Right. So if I'm just by myself, I think I would like a partner who is tall, who is like very professionally motivated. But then you meet somebody who has all those characteristics and they kind of leave you flat, and you meet somebody else and you notice that they smile at you or have a lovely sense of humor. And
exactly.
That gets you.
Exactly. And that's going to tell you something about who you are. And there's other things like that in the novel, you know, your experiences in the world, just even looking at trees, looking at hawthorns. Certainly looking at paintings and listening to concertos, all of that, if you're paying the right kind of attention, shines a light on you. But again, it's not just that, you know, if it's a concerto, it also shines a light on the other person. And it re-enchants the world, because people are different and difference is all inspiring. So the world gets re-enchanted.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Marcel Proust with our Stanford colleague and regular co-host, Josh Landy, whose new book is The World According to Proust.
Josh, what does it mean to pay the right kind of attention?
Well, just simply that you have to be, so, you know, let's say the example that Ray gave. You think you really want someone who's tall, but then you meet someone who isn't and you fall in love with them. Well, you could just leave it at that and just be happy with your partner. And that's great. I mean, it's good to be happy. But you could also take a moment to reflect, wait, what went wrong there in my self-understanding? You know, 5 minutes ago, I thought I really needed somebody to be tall. Now I'm with someone who isn't. That should help me to understand myself a little better.
So there's this famous scene where Proust's narrator takes a bite of a cookie and comes to understand himself. Like, should I be eating more cookies? How does that work?
Well, probably yes. But yeah, so That's it's such a lovely scene fairly early in the novel. And at this point, the narrator's in his middle age, unspecified age, but he hasn't eaten madeleines for a while. And he dips the madeleine in a cup of tea, eats some crumbs of the madeleine, and suddenly his childhood comes back to him in rich, vivid detail. It's like it's like a time machine. It's like or teleport. Like he's living it from within. He drops back into the self that he used to be then. Why is that so special? Well, interestingly, the character says, "I wasn't to find out for many years," and we actually find out like 2,600 pages later. So it's years of your life too. But it comes down to seeing something in himself that hasn't changed over all those years.
Is the novel going to try to mimic this just by being such a long novel that you can't remember the beginning by the time you get to the end?
That's brilliant, Ray. Like I actually think that's exactly one of the things that it does and why it needs to be so long. And it's not just that in a general sense there are things you forget, but more specifically, it constructs these brilliant little these little moves where it'll drop a tiny little hint early on, and then 2,000 pages later, suddenly that little seed sprouts into this massive tree, and you're like, oh my God, and it hits you in exactly the way that Madeleine episode hits the main character.
In the book, you mention that the Madeleine and the tea is a kind of a secular version of the wafer and the wine. And he's importing Christian Catholic iconography into his novel. And yet the source of transcendence is the self.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit about that. Is the self enough of a reed on which to hang this whole system of reenchantment or belief in reenchantment?
Yeah, I mean, great question. So, you know, the thought is, what do we want from, what does transcendence mean? Well, in one definition, it means basically leaving this world and entering another world, or believing in the possibility of another world. But what is another world? Well, it's a system that has its own laws. It's different from ours, but it's sort of the same as itself. It's internally consistent. Well, guess what? Another person is that, right? So the world, this is a metaphor that Proust and Rachel uses. Each of us has an internal world. And if I can enter your world by reading your writing, how incredible for me. And how incredible for you if you get to enter the world of Monet or Georgia O'Keeffe or Toni Morrison. It's amazing, right? So each person has a different world. We're all ruled by different internal mental laws. And the possibility of a glimpse into that really is enchanting. It feels like a transcendence. It feels like an entry into a different universe.
So if my internal world is really different from Blakey's internal world or your internal world, Josh, like how do we achieve that kind of connection where we can get into each other's internal worlds?
Well, you know, I think the everyday experience of art is a kind of clue to that, where, you know, when you see a really great movie, for example, where things are different. Think about science fiction, right? You're dropped into a very different kind of world, where maybe the gravity operates a little bit differently, and maybe, you know, social interactions operate differently. All these kinds of things operate differently. And we adjust pretty fast to these new rules, right? So it seems like as humans, we're quite capable of doing that. Only this isn't a fiction anymore. Now it's, you know, Ray Briggs' real inner world. And what an incredible honor to be able to spend a little bit of time visiting that world.
But like, okay, so I paint something, and there's like the painting for me, which is like inflected by my visual stuff, and there's the painting for you, which is inflected by your visual stuff. How do I know that those are going to line up?
Right, and there's no guarantee. And an experience of an artwork isn't just one thing, especially experience of something like Proust's novel, which is 3,000 pages that you might spend months, or in my case, years of your life reading. And so at different moments, you might be doing something different. So at one moment, while you're reading Proust's novel, you might be thinking about yourself. And that's, in fact, deliberate, right? So Proust talks about that, about how, you know, a good artwork should also be a mirror to the reader. But at other times, you're able to get yourself out of the way. just take yourself out of the picture, bracket yourself, as some philosophers would say, and allow yourself to be sort of productively taken over by the mind of somebody else. Simone de Beauvoir says it best. She says, the miracle of literature is that another person's thought becomes mine.
That's such a beautiful sentiment, and all I can think about is how distracted all of us are. I'm wondering if you if Proust would have a response to that. It's clearly worth it in your life to have pushed through to this.
Yeah, I think that's right. Again, this is more between the lines than anything else, but I think that one of the great virtues of this 3,000-page novel is that inculcates a set of mental virtues, one of which is patience. Yeah. You cannot read this 3,000-page novel without having a bit of an attention span. And I think, you know, it's a virtuous cycle. Start with a little bit of patience and attention span, and this novel is going to give you more. And it's going to give you, I think, habits of being able to store things away and store them kind of in a provisional way and think twice and revise. So I think you come out of this experience not just, I think, a happier person for knowing Proust, but I mean, maybe this sounds over-optimistic, but I actually think it equips you with mental skills that are really useful in today's world.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the life and thought of Marcel Proust with our resident expert, Josh Landy, author of The World According to Proust.
Is love just an illusion? Can you ever really know the object of your affection? What does Proust have to say about same-sex relationships?
Romantic illusions and elusive reality. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. If love is headed toward you, should you run to it or get away? I'm Ray Briggs, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for Josh Landy, who's here today as our guest as we go in search of Proust's philosophy.
So Josh, Proust's novel, In Search of Lost Time, it depicts same-sex relationships, but it's not exactly what I would call positive representation. Do you think it's still relevant to 21st century readers?
Yeah, you know, that's kind of what Gide said to Proust, André Gide, his fellow novelist. I don't think it's complicated. And Proust himself was gay, and he creates this character who isn't, a character who's straight, and seems really confused by same-sex relationships. And, you know, this character's got a very analytical mind, so he's desperately trying to understand it. But he isn't doing a very good job, in my opinion. And so he tries out all these different theories, many of which he's picked up from the environment around him. For example, one of the going theories at the time was that it was a vice. And another theory at the time was that it was a disease. And another theory at the time was it's not a vice or a disease. It's just the result of people ending up in the wrong body. So a woman ends up in the body of a man, and that's why that man is interested in other men. But then at times, this character is saying, no, it's none of those things. It's a blessing, right? It's the greatest thing that could happen to you because it equips you with all of these talents and aesthetic sensibilities. So it's a bit complicated. And so I don't know what to say about how to deal with it today because it's such a kind of rich mess of things.
Why do you think Proust chose to have a straight narrator?
It's such a fascinating choice. So the cynical answer is, get away with it, right? So might have been harder at the time, but you know, it wasn't impossible at the time wouldn't have been impossible for him to have a non-straight narrator. But I think it does something very interesting for us as readers. This novel isn't an autobiography, or an autobiography in disguise, and it's not a treatise. So we don't have a character who represents Proust, the author, telling us how to think about everything. For example, same-sex relationships. Instead, you have a character who's often very confused and contradicts himself and changes his mind or says something that, you know, you look around, you say, oh, you know what? No one can ever fall in love with somebody they actually like. And then you look and you say, wait, well, what about that page where you're talking about Elstir, right? That seems to be... So it's great for us as readers that we're challenged to put things together for ourselves and reach our own conclusions rather than having something handed to us on a plate.
It seems as though in the novel, same-sex relationships are, they're on a spectrum between the sort of very kind of lost and sad and actually the successful and worldly. I'm wondering if you have a sense of what that spectrum is like, or if you can talk us through it a little bit.
That's really well said, and I think it's important. It's very similar in a way to the spectrum of different sex relationships right. in the novel, where some seems to be going a lot better than others. And, you know, there's a lot in the novel that is really, you know, in spite of the fact that this is a straight narrator who's often very confused, it's really on the side of this poor persecuted minority. The longest sentence of many long sentences in the novel is about the plight of gay men in 20th century Europe, including Oscar Wilde. He's not named, but it's clearly about Oscar Wilde, who, you know, has undergone that awful court case. The opening of one of the volumes is this fantastic scene where two gay men find each other by miracle, and the narrator compares it to the miracle of a bee finding a flower in the middle of the city. And it's just so beautiful. So yeah, there's the spectrum is all there, right? So for people who are cruel to people who are kind, from people who are happy to people who are sad. But if you put it all together, you know, and again, reading a little bit between the lines, I like to think that the world of same-sex desire in the novel has something, in spite of those cases where it doesn't seem to be going great, it has something incredibly appealing about it, because what do people bond over in that world? They bond over who they are. And what we see, you know, community in Proust is often very vexed. And we see these, you know, highfalutin aristocrats bonding over snobbery and their disdain for people who aren't like them. And we see the French bonding over being French and you know, disdaining anything that isn't France. And this is not like that, right? So the world of same-sex desire is a world where people come together over a genuine part of who they really are. And so in spite of all the complexities, there's something kind of positive about that.
Yeah, so one of the narrator's love interests is bisexual, and he really struggles to understand that.
Yeah.
Like, what should we be, like, learning or taking away from his struggles?
Well, I think that this is, you know, what philosophers call the problem of other minds. How do we know what somebody else is thinking, or to put it more Proustianly, what their world is like? And this is a general problem in Proust. How do I know your world? I really want to. Right, I don't just want to be trapped inside my own skull. I want to be able to get out there, and you know, it's part of re-enchantment is to see this one world as a million worlds, because we're all looking at it differently. But how do I know? Can I do that? Now, for the character, it achieves its starkest form in this relationship, where he thinks that that Albertine is bisexual. She's interested not just in men but in women. And he says that this love for women was something I could not conceive. I couldn't imagine it.
Which is weird, because he falls in love with women.
Yes, that's right. So he can imagine being someone loving women, right? But he can't imagine being a woman loving women, right? And so that's, you know, of course, that might be in many ways a wrong-headed way of thinking about the situation. But for him, it's a particularly dramatic example of what he calls, you know, the barrier that's between me and the world of somebody else.
It's also really interesting that Proust, like, tries to get us to imagine our way into lack of imagination. Like, that's such a weird and cool thing to do as a novelist.
Yeah, I agree. And it's brilliant. And it's very powerful. I think, you know, because we're locked inside the perspective of this character for so long, doesn't mean we like everything he does. A lot of the things he does are quite questionable. We certainly don't like the way in which he's operating in this relationship. He's very jealous, very controlling. But it allows us that we really do get into the world of this character, and we feel with him the torment of not being able to enter the world of another human being.
Yeah, I mean, this also makes me wonder about true selves. So it doesn't seem like there's a guarantee that anybody's true self is somebody that I'm going to like.
Correct. That's absolutely right.
Maybe they just don't leave their partner alone because they're like, oh, who else are you seeing? Who else are you seeing? I don't like that.
No, right. And so that's an interesting thing. For the world to be reenchanted, it's enough that there be many, many, many different perspectives, including good and bad ones, right? That's okay for reenchantment. But for life to be good, that might not be enough, right? We might also need people to treat each other well. And that's really not something that comes up in a very ostentatious way in the novel. But again, there are scenes of people treating each other well, and there are scenes of treating each other badly. And it sure as heck seems as though we like the cases where people are treating each other well.
So Proust as a source of moral self-knowledge. What would you say about that?
Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, because that's going to be part of it, right? So self-knowledge. A lot of what self-knowledge looks like in Proust is what philosophers call a conceptual scheme. So the way in which I sort of put things in the world into categories. But hey, you know, it's true that part of, you know, who I am is also the values that I put on things. And many, many cases, they're going to be moral values. So the self-knowledge that I'm in search of when I look at Hawthorne's or think about the way I fall in love with people or react to an artwork, well, hopefully that points me in that direction too.
I also want to know about sort of some of the things you were saying earlier about error in addition to self-knowledge. So you've got the narrator making mistakes, not just about like moral truths, but about factual stuff.
Yes.
Like he makes a bunch of mistakes about like where the mole is on the face of somebody he falls in love with, where like not all of his beliefs can be true. How can we trust this narrator when he keeps telling us stuff that can't be true?
And we can't. And that's one of the great things about this novel. That it isn't an entirely reliable narrator, and that generates really important effects for us, right? If you wanted a treatise, it would be the worst thing. But it isn't a treatise, it's a novel. So yeah, you know, when he meets Albertine, he thinks he knows she has a mole on her face, but he remembers it as being in one place, and then 10 pages later on a different place. And he just reports it as fact. So we have to be very astute as readers. That's part of what I meant earlier when I was saying it equips us with useful mental capacities or strengthens our mental capacities. You know, we have to be savvy, right? And not necessarily accept things that are told to us. We have to weigh things up and, you know, give things the appropriate probabilistic weighting and evaluate. So that's one reason to do that. Another is that this novel's really interested in phenomenology, the way the world appears to us, rather than the way it actually is. So moments like that give us really the feel of what it is, what it's like to be a human being navigating uncertainly around a world that appears a certain way but might be different.
Do you think that he has a clearer and truer picture of the world at the end of the novel than at the beginning? Or is it just like one error after another error?
He does. I mean, so, you know, Proust wrote a letter to a critic where he said, the stuff my character says at the end of the first volume is the opposite of my real opinion, which will be revealed in the final volume. I'm forced to depict errors as though they were truths. Too bad for me if the reader takes them for the truth. So that's a deliberate thing. But it's true that by the end, the main character is wiser. I don't think he's completely wise. I think it would be a mistake to think, okay, it's all sorted out now. Probably that's off limits to us as human beings. But he's much further along than he was at the beginning.
Josh, can you say something about Proust tourism? Proust is an author who people love, and they love to go see his world. You have a long section in the book about why that's a mistake.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I hope nobody is offended, but I do criticize the whole industry of the town of Illiers that rebranded itself Illiers-Cambrai, because Cambrai is the name of the fictional town in the novel, and they sell madeleines and people come from all over. And I think there's some, you know, I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, but interestingly, Proust himself didn't like this kind of aesthetic tourism, which he called idolatry. So idolatry in religion is, of course, taking a thing for the sacred object. And
like a wafer.
Well, that's of course technically not idolatry, but yeah. But some people might say. And so here, you know, it's you're taking the town for the quasi sacred object, which is the book. So I think Proust thought it would be don't bother going to the town. Read the book. That's where the real magic is. And, you know, it's kind of a confusion to replace one with the other.
Right. So how much inquiring about Proust would Proust be okay with? Like, do we get to look at any details of his biography?
I mean, it's a lovely question. So one of the things I love most in Proust's thinking about art, which was an idea that was behind the, you know, the origin of this novel, is that you really can separate the artwork from the very often boring life of the artist. And just because the artist was boring, that doesn't mean the artwork's boring. Just because, you know, and the three big artists in the novel, one of them is ridiculous, one of them is pretentious, you know, one of them is a prude. But it doesn't matter. You know, the prude writes great septet, and the pretentious person makes incredible paintings. So I think this applies to Proust too. There's a fantastic biographies of Proust. One is 800 pages long. It's very, very good. You learn, in my opinion, nothing about the novel, right? It just doesn't help us. Proust's own life is extremely mundane and in some ways rather sad. One Proust scholar says, the miracle of miracles is that from that life, you end up with this novel. So again, don't worry about Proust. Just read the novel.
It's inspiring. Even the boring among us can create great art. Josh, thank you so much for coming back to the guest chair this week.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest has been my usual co-host, Josh Landy, professor of French and comparative literature at Stanford University, and author of a brand new book, The World According to Proust. And thanks, Blakey, once again, for stepping into the host chair.
A pleasure. We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man who doesn't lose any time, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Frankenstein's remained unread by many for so long, it seems like it was written yesterday, just to take the starch out of the Frankenstein myth, which came from movies. Movies that ignored everything about the book except the premise. The original Frankenstein monster, like Tarzan, is not a creature of the movies. He and Tarzan can speak just fine. Tarzan has a British accent. The point is, I have read Frankenstein, and I have read Tarzan. Well, it may have been just Tarzan and the Jewels of Opar, to be honest. I have not read In Search of Lost Time. I'm sorry. Time and the lack of French got the best of me. Still, ignorance has yet to stop me from having an opinion. What do I know about Proust? Well, let's see. For this bedridden author, a cookie brings back memories. I know that much. A petite Madeleine is a cookie, isn't it? Colette, she was also bedridden. Did she and Proust ever date? No, they did not. See, I know a lot about French literature. Simenon was actually Belgian. So was Hergé. If you think about it, we know a great deal about literature without knowing anything at all. The Three Musketeers, never read it. Seen, I believe, 5 different movies. Jules Verne, he'll put you to sleep immediately, but the movies have a certain charm. H.G. Wells is fun to read, but I got in a fistfight with a kid just before I saw The Time Machine in 1960, so movies win. There are the books everybody read when I was in college. Catch-22, Lord of the Rings, The Teachings of Don Juan, Hermann Hesse, Vonnegut. Hermann Hesse had a cult following. Let that sink in. As I got older, the unread books piled up. I found a used Oxford English Dictionary, and it still has pride of place on my sagging bookshelf. 50 years gone by, I have yet to look up a word in it. I could put my back out with that thing. The world has books that were sparsely read, then suddenly sold like jumbo Madeleines, like Philip K. Dick. There are huge authors that are read no more, like James Michener, Leon Uris, John D. MacDonald, Robert Ludlum. Still famous, not read, Ben-Hur, Gone with the Wind, Uncle Tom's Cabin. My family, of which I was by far the biggest reader, subsisted mainly on a diet of magazines. My mother read mysteries. My father only read 2 novels that I know of, Lord of the Flies and From Here to Eternity. But my folks bought the Great Books of the Western World series, took up an entire wall of our living room. It looked great, but I don't think anyone in the family read even one great book. My mother finally gave the set away not long before she passed. Yet we have more books than ever. Just for example, 2,000 Mules, the book version of the movie by Dinesh D'Souza, which claims without evidence that the election was rigged. Which election? I'll take a wild guess. I don't think anybody has actually read 2,000 Mules, though the movie is required viewing at GOP fundraisers. I keep thinking of the William Castle shockers from my youth. I wonder if D'Souza wires the seats or a skeleton swing over the audience's head. Goodwill is home to the novels of Tom Wolfe, the entire catalog of Ann Coulter, and Tom Clancy. In Search of Lost Time will never be found at Goodwill. However, I have seen copies of Madeline. You might remember. In an old house in Paris that was covered with vines, lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. In two straight lines, they broke their bed and brushed their teeth and went to bed. They left the house that past nine, two straight lines, in rain or shine. The smallest one was Madeline. See? The smallest one was Madeline. You might even say Madeline was petite. And I have fond memories of that book. Petite Madeline triggers memories. See? It all ties in. If I was angling for a PhD, my thesis would write itself. I'd still have to learn French, though, I guess. Damn. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Yi-Chi Shi, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Lamb.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Good morning.
So you do get up. I was beginning to think perhaps you worked in bed like Marcel Proust.
Who's he?
You wouldn't know him. French writer.
Come into my boudoir.